and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA News. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for joining us for the program this week. My guest is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. Want to point out to you right at the start, this week's program has been pre-recorded, so we cannot take your phone calls this week. You can always send an email, though, for any of our four mayors to ask@WBAA.org, and you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Afternoon, how are you?
You know, think about this. We are pre-recording this, so technically this is for the future.
But
right?
It's still in the afternoon, you see.
Well, that's a good sign. But we don't know what it might be like when this is actually played.
No, and I actually want to start with that because...
We're going to do a future question.
Right. Where you and I are both going to be when this show airs for the first time is watching Howard Schultz, the former CEO of Starbucks, who is coming to campus. And it's under this interesting banner of he says he's going to make what his people call a major policy announcement. And we got to talking about it here in the newsroom and we started thinking, well, here's a guy who's not technically a candidate for president of the United States yet, but is thinking about it. Here's a guy who's not technically the CEO of a major corporation, Starbucks, like he was until fairly recently. And so if you're not a candidate and you're not a CEO, what are you going to do policy-wise? And the supposition all over the place is he going to announce at Purdue that he's running for president? It would be an interesting thing to do because here's a guy who is from New York, lives in Washington.
Yeah.
Why would you announce?
And he invented, like, the greatest coffee ever.
I don't drink coffee, so I don't know.
Stan, come on. You're this hyped up without caffeine?
Yes. Imagine if
no,
I had caffeine.
No, can't.
Right. Can you imagine how that program would go for you?
Yeah, that would tickle, yes.
So I'm not going to ask you about the politics of the Howard Schultz thing, but I do want to ask you how it affects your city because— In 2016, we saw Gary Johnson and we saw Bernie Sanders come here. And I imagine that when a high-profile person comes, especially during a presidential election year, that there is some impact on your city. So let me ask about it to start from the law enforcement perspective. What is the impact on your police force or indeed on the county sheriff's office to try to provide security or something like that? Because I imagine it's kind of all hands on deck.
Oh, man, it absolutely is. And I'm going to act my age for a while, or at least I'm going to show my age for a while. I never seem to get the age part down. Way back in 1988, we had a sitting president visit here. Ronald Reagan came to Purdue University. And I was just a young cop over in Lafayette working the midnight to eight shift. And one of my responsibilities is I had to do some perimeter stuff, and then I had to guard the door. And so been up all night long, and I'm sitting there standing by the door, and I had my campaign hat on, and I was looking all pretty in my uniform and everything after having worked a shift. And I had no idea what was going on, you know. And then as I'm standing there leaning by the door, all these limousines, these great big black limousines pull up. And I'm thinking, okay, this looks weird. And so I shift to the other side of the door. Then the door opens up, and three guys with, you know, sunglasses and mics in their ears walk out. And in the midst of them all is President Ronald Reagan. And I was standing there, and he just leaned over and said, "Thank you, young man," and shook my hand. That was pretty cool. Of course, unfortunately, I was half asleep at the time. I didn't get one word out of my mouth, and kind of off goes the Gipper, and here I am sitting there with my hand still in the air. But to the point, to your point, Stan, yes, it is all hands on deck. All the agencies get involved. The federal agencies get involved. We have communications with the Secret Service to sort of get a general idea of where the dignitaries are going to be and when. There's a lot of exterior security that's involved. You've got to cordon off areas. You've got to do things with dogs that have sensitivities to different kinds of things like bombs and things like that. It is an absolute focused, basically frontal assault on trying to make sure that the dignitary is secured and also to make sure that the area is secured. And it is very involved, and it involves a great deal of planning. And the good thing about it is that most of the commanders in our police world around here in Greater Lafayette have been trained to do that. They've all had some form of dignitary protection. I know here at Purdue...
That's a specific type of training?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I know here at Purdue, Chief Cox and his team have done an amazing job. There's a lot of folks that come to Purdue now specifically with President Daniels being in charge, that they've had to do some pretty extensive research on and make sure that they do the right thing to keep people safe. The other thing of it is that there's that focused concern about, you know, dignitary protection. And then there's that secondary tier of issues when it comes to protesters, when it comes to people trying to create a secondary incident that might draw attention away from your security force.
I was going to ask about that, because it would seem like if there is the knowledge that some dignitary is in town and you've got a bunch of police who are at that person's event, mm-hmm. does that leave less patrolling for the rest of the area because there are just mm-hmm. fewer bodies?
Yeah. There's only so many people you can get there. It does to some degree. Again, I go back to the 80s event that we had, because that was the one where I was most materially involved. At least I've been in planning stages since that point when I was deputy chief. But in this particular one, as I was actually an officer that was doing the job. Yes, it does tax your available resources. But dispatch, all the dispatchers have coordinated dispatching. Back in those days, it was via telephone call. Now it's because of the channels that they use. They're more, even more directly linked now through the computer systems that they have. But you do have what they call a skeleton force that are going to respond to calls. The calls are obviously triaged. Calls for service, you know, like doing a VIN check or a barking dog call or something to that effect, might be put on a back burner. If there's accidents, if there's traffic issues about when people are coming and going, specifically dignitaries and their teams, those things are immediately addressed with. But generally speaking, for the period of time that the program or the dignitary is speaking, that's when it's all hands on deck and there's a very focused enforcement presence, and the secondary is sort of the periphery stuff, making sure traffic flows smoothly, and in the event that there's some form of critical call, that there's some staff that can be directed to that.
Is that a bit of a headache? Because
it is a huge headache. It is a huge headache. I mean, don't get me wrong. We are always honored when people choose our community to either make a special announcement or even come to speak, because it really does. It's prestigious for a community to be able to host that level of dignitary.
Well, and that's what I'm getting at. Is there a balancing act between wanting to have your community noted as the place that is viewed as important enough for someone who is running for president, for instance, to come visit, versus the headaches and perhaps, and address this if you would, the monetary cost mm-hmm. of maybe overtime and having to bring out extra equipment to deal with mm-hmm. getting mm-hmm. that publicity?
Yeah, it is an investment. I mean, it really is an honor. You know, when President Reagan came, I mean, it put Greater Lafayette on the map. Back in the early 80s, the only thing we were known for were a few really cool factories in Lafayette. And then Purdue University. But when Reagan came, we started to become more of a focal point for political announcements and for having those higher level speeches. When they decide to choose us to make announcements, it really is sort of a status point for your community. So in a way, it's a pretty significant investment. The investment on the part of local government, though, is twofold. First off, obviously, it helps us do things in the event of some major catastrophe happening, like a tornado. It requires a lot of interagency cooperation. It requires a great deal of planning. So a lot of folks get together and sort of sketch these things out, and they throw up a lot of hypotheticals. So it's a really good training exercise in reality in the event that these things occur.
It's its own sort of tornado.
There you go. It's its own sort of man-made tornado. But I think, And I hate this phrase, but I think at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, cliche after cliche, it really does benefit the community as a whole. People get to see how professional their law enforcement agencies are. People get to see and be proud of how we stand at attention, how we salute the dignitaries when they come and go, if required. With the exception of me standing out in the back door when President Reagan
Would there be a dignitary you don't have to stand and salute for?
It depends. I mean, sometimes they don't want to have the vehicle identified.
Oh, I see.
And if you'll notice, like the caravans, you'll see several different black Suburbans. You don't know which one.
So that wasn't a value judgment on a particular politician coming to town?
No, not at all. You know, with the exception of me when I was half asleep at a back door. But it really is, it is sort of a status symbol for a community. It provides a great deal of interagency, you know, cooperation. It's a great training opportunity. And depending upon who the dignitary is, it could be something that particular officer might remember for the rest of their life.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. This show has been pre-recorded, so we cannot take your phone calls today, but do email at any time for any of our four mayors. Our address, ask@wbaa.org. We talked in a previous program about the future of recycling in mm-hmm. West Lafayette in between your last visit and now. One of our listeners, Mary Jo, emailed wondering what the latest update was on plans between the city and the county for mm-hmm. the future of that.
Still talking about it. I actually talked to our street commissioner, Ben Anderson, this morning at our staff meeting. The toters are still there. The roll-offs that, that the recycling goes into is still there. And I think I need to make a point of clarification here. Our recycling program is intact. The one where we have the toters in front of every address.
The curbside recycling.
Curbside, yeah. That's not going anywhere. This is just the toters that we host for Tippecanoe County, or the roll-offs that we host for Tippecanoe County. Because of the limitations of space that we have at our street department facility, we're just geographically landlocked. We need that space to build barns so we can put our trucks under roofs so they don't rot in the middle of the winter. So those four or five, actually there's about eight roll-offs that are there, we're looking to relocate. And again, we're still in conversation with the county commissioners to figure out what the best way to treat this entire recycling issue will be, insofar as roll-off toters and insofar as recycling pickup in Tippecanoe County. They're looking for strategic locations to put the roll-offs. And unfortunately, they're also looking at ways to better monitor the systems that they have now, because unfortunately, some of the roll-offs are being abused. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's going in there that shouldn't go in there. And so it's an ongoing conversation to figure out what that next best step will be.
I got to ask, what's going in there that shouldn't?
Animals.
Live or dead?
Yes. Refrigerators, stoves, gas tanks, lawnmowers, etc. And then some rather disgusting garbage as well.
All right. So let's confine this to the actual recyclables for the purposes of this discussion. You said on our previous program that one of the problems you're having, and we've heard this elsewhere, is that recyclable materials are not as profitable to the people who collect them and sell them as they used to be. And for a long time, for instance, you would have Chinese companies say, yes, we're happy to buy your recyclables and ship them overseas. You're not seeing that as much. I got to thinking about
the fact that
it's always scary. When you have a source, a supply chain like that, and you have one end of that supply chain that might say, yeah, we're not quite as interested in playing the part that we used to, has the city or the county investigated whether there might be another end result for this? We're seeing, for instance, there was a press release from Purdue University researchers today saying that they're doing research into taking plastics and making them into fuel, for instance, which ostensibly could be a way you could get rid of those. Or maybe there's another country whose industry is more interested now than China is, for instance, in buying that. Have you investigated the other end of your own supply chain to determine if there's another way to divert that but keep it more or less the same for the people here who are getting in on the front end?
The products that we basically market go just go down the road. They go to what's called a MRF. It's a sorting center, and that's where the marketing is actually done. Now, what we have done is we have looked into the business ourselves because, again, it's we feel like responsible government makes sure that we don't get caught blindsided. And if this market's just the bottom's going to fall out, and they might not be such a thing as profitable recycling anymore, we need to be in a position to be able to respond to that. And the truth of this isn't necessarily that people aren't wanting the products anymore. The truth is that they're not paying as much for them. There will always be a need to recycle. The products that they recycle eventually can be reused. But there used to be a premium.
I will say it's a form of demand one
way or exactly, the other. Exactly. And so when everybody's behaving as they should, when they're being good citizens and they're putting things in the proper receptacles and they're going to the right places to be processed into some form of reusable product, everybody does it. There's a lot more, and the prices fall out. I don't know that it'll ever reach that point to where it's going to go back to, any port in a storm, just throw it wherever it needs to go. Because I think a lot of these countries realize that positive disposal of waste products is good for them as a country, good for cities, and good for humanity.
Let me ask about the other end. I talked about the very end of that supply chain. One of the other things that we're hearing more and more about is on the front end. For a long time, I have been able to take my recycling out to my curbside toter and just dump the whole kit and caboodle in the toter, and it gets taken away and ostensibly out of sight from me, gets sorted somewhere else, and everything goes where it's supposed to. The paper one place, the plastic another place. But now what we're hearing more and more is that maybe we've been kind of foolish all along to think that that's actually happening well as we thought. Do you need to maybe educate the populace that, hey, if you want to continue doing this, if you want to continue doing your part, mm-hmm. then you're going to have to spend a little more time on the front end sorting your recyclables, taking a look at those little things on the bottom of the packages mm-hmm. to determine if they are the right numbers, the right type of plastic, things mm-hmm. like that, and understanding that there's going to have to be more effort on the part of everybody because the change has come to where municipal government is mm-hmm. feeling it. And now, if you want to help citizen, well, guess what? Mm-hmm. Maybe there needs to be some more effort from you when you take it to your curbside toter.
This is I got a great story about this. When I was a little kid, I was a Cub Scout. And every year as a Cub Scout, we used to do these things called paper drives. Did you ever do those when you were a kid?
I'm aware of them, but I did not do them.
Yeah, back in the 60s, we would go knocking. I mean, everybody knew that this was the deal, right? So we'd go knocking on doors, and people would give us their newspapers tied up in these wonderful bundles, and we would put them in our wagons and take them to basically a big roll-off at the school and dump them in there, and they'd take it to, you know, paper recycling land, and everybody would live happily ever after. That was one of the preliminary forms of recycling, you know? Cub Scouts, we rock. We started recycling. So the big deal was is that when you were preparing the papers to be recycled, and I remember this vividly, my parents said, okay, if you're going to recycle those things or if you're going to give them to the Cub Scouts, of which I was one, you got to get all the magazines out. You got to get all the stuff out. It just has to be the newspapers. And as a little kid, it's like, okay, I can tear this because it's paper and I can tear that because it's paper. But we didn't know that the products basically deteriorated differently. Well, now let's fast forward 50 years. That's embarrassing to say. And we're still sort of in that same mode. Oh, no, let me back. Let's fast forward 30 years when West Lafayette started its recycling program. Back in the early days when Mayor Marjoram started the recycling program, it was just as critical. We had to wash your plastics. You had to peel the labels off, separate those, wash the glass, peel the labels off, separate those, and then bundle the paper. And it could only be true paper, you know, like newspaper or brown paper bags. That was the first iteration of the community recycling program. And from that point, we went to where we are today, where it's just commingled. And you throw it all into a toter. We throw it onto the back of a truck. That truck is taken down to a MRF where it's separated. And each one of those products are packaged up and sent to China or sent to Russia or sent to Japan or sent to Taiwan.
Assuming they can be separated.
Correct. Correct. And that's where the money's
made. Which is kind of a big assumption more and more people are saying.
Well, it's getting worse and worse because this little bottle that I'm drinking out of, that was my sound effect for your radio show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I understand another mayor does that all the time, and I'm not going to be like that guy. But this is probably a recycled product. This isn't probably the original form that this stuff came in.
Yeah, in fact, I can see the recycling symbol on the side of it as we speak next to the barcode.
There you go, yeah. See? So, I mean, you know, we live in a time now where recyclables are repeatedly recycled, and I don't know what this ends up being. They tell me that the end of life of a recycled product is those bags that we put our groceries in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why a lot of those you'll see blowing on fence posts around.
Well, and we also hear that there is only so many times you can recycle something.
Yeah, but that's the death of recycling is when it's grocery bag.
Okay.
So
on to other things.
Yes,
President Trump's State of the Union speech this week again mentioned funding for a border wall. And I got to thinking about you as mayor of a city with a large immigrant population that's mm-hmm. here 9 months a year at least. How do you think the constant talk about that, especially as we got out of the recent government shutdown, mm-hmm. is affecting the people here who come to West Lafayette from other countries?
It is absolutely disastrous. It is such an emotional issue for people that have come from other countries. Nobody in my house, myself, my daughter, my wife, was born in America. We were all born in different parts of the world. And you know, my wife's family comes over here to visit. Immigration is what America's all about, for God's sake. I understand that there is a need to do something to control the ebb and flow of humanity across the borders. I get that. But what we're talking about now is isolating a very specific population base and making them feel worrisome about their status. The other thing that we're dealing with here is there are presidents throughout our history have had issues that have been very controversial. And they have spent time in trying to craft dialogue that will be less inflammatory and less damaging than what we're talking about by building walls. And when you talk to folks, my brother, he lives in Texas. And when we talk about these issues, he says, John, you ought to see how it is. He said, there are people that come over every day. He said, and then they go back. And we never talk about that. That doesn't seem to be an issue when we're talking about building a wall. It seems like keeping everybody out, but they come here, they work, and they go back and do what they need to do for their families. So I think the president's intent is to try and solve a problem that is through a system, through a method that has the visible impact that's twofold. It's going to threaten people that live in this country, and it's going to feel that we're doing something isolationist, which when you look at your history – and you see how governments that have done that, where they've ended up. Second thing is that the mechanism itself is flawed. You talk to people that have walls within their on the border by where they live. They're easy to penetrate. You just walk a little bit further down, and you can swim underneath them. So their impact probably has a greater deterrence predicated on fear than they do in the reality of actually being a barrier. So I think what it does for us here in West Lafayette, I think that there are a lot of folks who fear for their status. I think there's a lot of folks, particularly here at the university, who wonder what's that next big thing going to be.
So we did a story about a year ago. I did a story that aired nationally on Morning Edition that pointed out that a number of Midwestern universities, Purdue certainly included, are seeing declines in their international enrollment. And there are multiple mm-hmm. reasons for that. But we did talk to a number of people who said that the so-called America First policies are playing into that. Mm-hmm. I just listened to the story the other day again, and I remembered, and I was reminded of this woman I talked to who worked at Earlham College, who said that she was at a recruiting fair overseas, and someone walked up to her, and she had her banner there on the table, mm-hmm. Handing out all of the information. And the prospective student said, "Oh, you're from America, huh?" And she said, "Yes." And she said, the student's response was telling, and the student said, "Nope, can't go there. Got to go to Canada or Great Britain instead." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's being felt here? Because we know Purdue's international enrollment mm-hmm. is down, and Purdue has relied heavily on the full freight paid by those international students for a long time to help do things like finance the tuition freeze and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I imagine it's going to hurt your city's bottom line, too, because you're doing all this investment along State Street. Mm-hmm. You've got some very, very expensive apartments that are being put up there, some of them more mm-hmm. than $3,000 a month, ostensibly, if the families of people who can afford mm-hmm. full freight international tuition mm-hmm. can also afford a very nice apartment in one of the new high-rises along State Street, it seems like this has a multiplier effect for a city like yours.
Well, I think it probably less in reality than it does in reputationally. Let me explain. I think that a lot of the folks that are looking at Purdue University and West Lafayette as a place to get an education probably come from a situation where financially they were in a position to be able to afford to get here. They're in a position to be able to afford proper accommodations. Visas and passports and all that and will be in line. I think that's going to be okay. I think reputationally, you know, there are those that probably are thinking, you know, if they don't want us, why should we go? I mean, it's kind of like, if you're not going to dance with me, then why would I go to the dance in the first place? I think that's going to be an issue. And then the other thing is when you look at the world as a whole, when you think of things in a collaborative sort of global way, everything's changing. I mean, we live in such a transitional period now in our history to where borders sometimes are barriers for survival. And it's not just a matter of being able to get a job or to bring home food for that particular meal. It's literally an issue of survival. There are some areas that are so heavily tainted with pollution where people really can't live there anymore.
Well, so not to get too far away from the question, but it all seems to go back to the idea of demand like we were talking about earlier. And that seems to be the buzzword of today's mm-hmm. show, because you need demand for the education at Purdue University to be strong mm-hmm. so that demand for the apartments along State Street mm-hmm. is strong, so that the demand for the new Target that's going mm-hmm. up is strong, mm-hmm. For whatever's going to be the new Chauncey Hill Mall in a couple of years is going to be strong. Mm-hmm. If demand, broadly speaking, writ large, goes down, so does all of the money flowing into all of those other businesses, mm-hmm. and thus possibly so does all of the property tax money that comes back into the city, which mm-hmm. can then be reinvested in whatever is the next big thing, mm-hmm. right?
I honestly don't think that's the case. And you know me, I wouldn't just blow smoke.
You don't think you're going to lose money on this?
No, I don't think that because of the stand that our president has on immigration, I don't think that's going to change what goes on insofar as enrollment, insofar as our international population. However, when you look at some of the other social issues that are creating some concern right now, when you look at all the hate crimes that are on the rise, when you look at, you know, the stronger presence of groups like the Klan their membership is supposedly on the rise. That, to me, would generate more terror and more fear than having sort of an arbitrary stand on immigration, when the folks that will be coming here generally are going to abide by the rules because they're in a position to be able to do so.
One or two last topics in our last couple of minutes here. Have you filed your paperwork for re-election officially
yet? Yes, I'm in the game. I'm ready to go.
Okay. Are you aware of anyone who's challenging you, either from the Republican Party in a primary or from the Democratic Party?
Not that I've heard, no. No, I haven't.
I have to say that's not surprising in a way.
Yeah, why? Because I've got things so messed up, nobody wants to touch it.
No. But I have to say, and I will say this next thing is not at all mean spirited in any way. Mm-hmm. But you are what used to be derisively referred to as a RINO, R-I-N-O, Republican in name only.
Really?
You have your stances, your political ideology. Not Republican. You've talked on this program and plenty of other places about how you came to have an R next to your name on a ballot. You've also talked about the way that you interact with local Republicans who say they are broadly happy with the job you have done as mayor. And we've also talked to all of the mayors on this program about how if you do it right, the job of local mayor should not be necessarily a partisan
one. Yeah.
It should be about getting things done for the citizens.
Mm-hmm.
But as you think about going into a fourth term, years potentially 13 through 16 in this office, where you've had that letter next to your name, which you've never been totally comfortable with, and which I assume people like Eric Burns, the head of the county Republican Party, aren't also 100% comfortable with. How do you look at that? How do you look at, especially in the age with the way that people are saying the president has changed the ideal of what is a Republican in the United States? You were just talking a second ago about all of the different things that has wrought. How do you view yourself as a RINO, and again, I mean that nicely, going into potentially your next run for election?
This is going to sound so weird. I was never involved in politics until I was. I'm not a political guy. I've never been a political guy. And fortunately, I've been able to be a mayor without having that burden. You know, I get it. I know that you have to be something because in order to be elected, you have to have a party affiliation. And don't get me wrong. You know, I'm not offended by Republicans. I am a Republican. I'm running as a Republican.
You're running as a Republican.
Right.
Whether you are is debatable.
Yeah, everybody seems to throw that coin up in the air, don't they?
Yeah.
But because when you work for a population base like the population base that I serve here in West Lafayette, the last thing I worry about is my political affiliation. I worry about making sure we have a good budget. I'm worried about making sure it's safe. I'm worried about we're a high quality and focused community that really does want to make sure quality of life is a value. And people, and when you look at all the lists, we're usually in the top 10. So we must be doing something right. And what that means is that we're leading right. We're providing all the right things, and it doesn't have to be politically driven.
All right. Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time, and look forward to seeing you at the Howard Schultz thing and on this program next month.
You got it.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember to join us next week at this same time for our conversation with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. Send your questions at any time to our address, ask@WBAA.org, and you can find all of these shows archived on the Ask the Mayor page at WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.